when you hear this phrase endlessly trotted out by the media, and you say, well, where's the evidence of wrongdoing? It tells you how deep in the swamp they all are. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Steve Hilton Show. The big story this week that was dominating the headlines, for all the reasons you know very well, was the Hunter Biden story, which, of course, is actually the Joe Biden corruption story. It was all over the news because, of course, you had all the drama on Capitol Hill where Hunter Biden was supposed to go there and testify, and he's had the subpoena and he defied it, did a press conference outside saying this is a witch hunt, basically borrowing all the language that Donald Trump uses. Let's not dwell on that too much, saying it's all just a political stunt to attack him and so on and so forth, right? We know the story. But here's the point I wanted to make about it, which is this phrase that is constantly used by the media, most of the media when I'm reporting on this. It's absolutely infuriating, and it really goes to the heart of what this story is about. And I just want to explain what I mean by that. The phrase that drives me crazy every time I hear it, and you hear it in these so-called news reporters when they're discussing what's going on, is this: no evidence of wrongdoing. You hear it all the time. You hear it when they're interviewing people, when they're, if you watch CNN and they're challenging James Comer or whatever, like, but there's no evidence of wrongdoing. And even in their reports, when they say Republicans are pressing ahead with their impeachment inquiry, even though there's no evidence of wrongdoing, no evidence of wrongdoing. What they mean by that, to try and be fair to them, is that there hasn't yet been any evidence uncovered of actual criminal activity by Joe Biden. That is what I think they mean by that. But of course, they say no evidence of wrongdoing. But the whole thing that's going on here is wrongdoing. But the fact that the media and the establishment and the Democrat politicians and many Republicans in the establishment too just blow it all off and say there's no evidence of wrongdoing reveals why this story is so important and why it is absolutely in the public interest for us to really pursue it, for the Republicans to press ahead, and for an example to be made of this. Why? Because what's going on with this Biden story, again, not the Hunter Biden story, but the Biden family corruption story, the Joe Biden corruption story, is the business model of the swamp. That's what it is. The Biden family business model is the swamp's business model. And the fact that everybody does it is why they keep saying there's no evidence of wrongdoing. But the fact that everyone does it doesn't make it right. In fact, it makes it wrong. It's wrong that everyone does it. What do I mean when I say everyone does it? What I mean is they exploit public office for private, personal, financial gain. That's what this whole thing is about. And there's plenty of evidence of that. It's right there in the facts of the story. The fact that Hunter Biden's entire professional career, if you go back and look at what he's done, everything he's done professionally, going right back to when Joe Biden was a senator and Hunter Biden got a job at a law firm as a lobbyist within a law firm representing the industries that are in Delaware, lobbying, influence peddling, selling access. That's what they all do. They're all at it in Washington. And then you go on and you look at what happened when Joe Biden was vice president and all these jobs and contracts that Hunter Biden got. Burisma, he said it himself. And he actually said, unbelievably, I'm proud, at that press conference outside the Capitol. Hunter Biden literally said, I'm proud of the global business relationships I've established. What are you talking about? What is there to be proud of? The only reason he got those jobs, it's perfectly obvious to everyone, is because his dad was the vice president. And more than that, that his dad, as vice president, was responsible for those particular places. He was in charge of Ukraine policy. That's why a Ukrainian energy company wanted his son on their board. That's it. There's no other explanation. He had no professional background in energy, didn't know anything about Ukraine. There's nothing else other than the fact that his father was the vice president. That is, no one's disputing that. That didn't even need to be uncovered by the Republicans. That is a fact. That fact itself is wrongdoing. So when they say there's no evidence of wrongdoing, the fact that Hunter was on the board of Burisma is wrongdoing. The fact that Hunter was on the plane with the vice president, Air Force Two, when he went to China on an official visit, and he took Hunter along to do business deals on the side, which is, again, is not disputed. And in fact, Hunter Biden says he's proud of it. That is evidence of wrongdoing. Hunter Biden's entire career is evidence of wrongdoing. So when you hear this phrase endlessly trotted out by the media, and you say, well, where's the evidence of wrongdoing? It tells you how deep in the swamp they all are. Because they seriously don't think there's anything wrong with this, because they know that pretty much everyone in Washington does it. They've got their family members on the payroll. It's the revolving door between politics and government and industry. They all kind of, you know, when they leave their office, they go and get a job as a lobbyist, and they lobby for the exact industries that they're represented. I mean, the real in Congress it's highly specific. They all go on these specific committees that regulate particular industries. If you're on the finance committee, then you regulate Wall Street, and you get it. Then you leave, you get a job with a Wall Street bank or a lobbying firm that represents Wall Street, and so on. And they may call it a law firm or a strategic advisory firm or whatever, but it's cashing in on your public office, and they all do it. That's what I mean when I say that's the business model of the swamp. They have this sense. It's really interesting, and I know these people. You know, I've been in and around government for a long time. This is how they think. I want you to really understand this. Don't just listen to this. Don't judge. Just hear that this is truly how they feel. They feel, this is politicians and also people who work in the government generally, that when they go in to do this, when they run for office and they become and they get elected, or they serve in the administration in some sort of, you know, other capacity, they are paid less than they would be in the private sector. So a lot of these people, they go to fancy universities and so on, and they see their friends who've worked in the private sector, done something, you know, productive, and they get paid a lot more. And they are sitting there thinking, well, why don't I have that, right? My friend Jim, who I was a roommate with at Harvard or whatever, he's now at some fancy law firm earning, you know, 20 times what I am. He's got this fantastic house, and he's got the holiday home, and he's going to fancy vacations, and his kids are all at private school. Meanwhile, I'm stuck in this sort of little house in my district, whatever. That's how they think. And they feel entitled to more money because their peer group, people who work in the private sector, they have more money. That's what's driving all this. So they think it's literally a perk of the office that once you've done your time doing your public service, then you can cash in. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's part of the whole system. That's what they sincerely believe. They don't even, that's why there's no evidence of wrongdoing is such a key phrase. They don't believe that it's wrong. They don't actually think that what Hunter Biden did was wrong, this cashing in on his dad's public service. They think it's fine because they do it as well. All the Democrats do it. Most of the Republicans do it. The media know that. All the people in journalism there, the reporters, they're all that sort of, they all go to the same dinner parties in Washington. They're all part of the same system, all part of the swamp, which is a very useful term to describe all this. They don't think there's anything wrong with it. So that's what's driving that phrase, no evidence of wrongdoing. But of course, there's a massive amount wrong with it. Why? Because that knowledge that you're going to get a job somehow connected to your public service in the private sector after you've stopped doing it, or that your family member is cashing in. And remember, it's not just in the Biden case, it's not just Hunter Biden, it's the whole family. I mean, I've detailed this many times. I did it on my Fox show. I mean, you read Peter Schweitzer's book. I mean, he's done the real digging on all of this. You look at Frank Biden. What's the other one? I could, James. You know, the contracts for, you know, military contract to build military housing in the Gulf War when he was vice president. Sorry, in Iraq. There's one of them. I mean, I can't even remember the details now. People, you can check it out. They're literally following him around. There's some telecoms contract in a Caribbean island. One of the brothers got when he went with Joe Biden when he was vice president. You know, it's just unbelievable. It's shameless. So everywhere Joe Biden went or whatever he did, he had a family member trotting along, cashing in on it. So they're one of the worst. Really egregious. Really obvious. It's not just Hunter. It's all of them. But the reason it is wrong, I mean, I don't begrudge people working and getting rich. That's fantastic. That's the free market economy. I want people to earn a living and do really well. But we want to do it in a way that's consistent with the values of an entrepreneurial free enterprise economy. You start a business and it's successful and you make money. Fantastic. Good luck to you. But this kind of thing, cashing in on public service, no, that's not okay. And the reason it's not okay is it ends up distorting public policy. So let's just say you're a senior official in the Defense Department, right? You know that once you stop doing that, you're going to be offered either a board seat or a senior role or something with the defense contractors, with Raytheon and Northrop Grumman and all the rest of it, Lockheed Martin. And so you're thinking about that as you're implementing public policy. And you're not focused solely on public policy. You've got one eye on your future career. And this is also true if you're in Congress and you're serving on the Agriculture Committee. And then you're thinking, well, when I've stopped doing this, you know, I'm going to get a job at Monsanto or whatever it is. And so it actually comes back, and the future expectation of this revolving door and this cashing in, whether it's currently with family members in contemporaneously or in future with you getting a job in one of the industries, one of the companies that you regulate somehow or other, whether that's in the executive branch or the legislative branch, it affects your behavior today. If it affects public policy, it's corrupt. Of course it's wrong. But they don't see it as wrong. And that's why this phrase, no evidence of wrongdoing, is so infuriating. And it's so important to go behind it and understand that. And that's why it really matters that we pursue this story of the Biden family corruption, because it is very a really egregious example of what they all do. And it needs to be exposed. And people need to see it. And there need to be reforms put in place to stop this kind of thing from happening. That's why it matters. That's why it's not just a political. Of course, the Republicans think they're going to benefit politically. I get that. But it is a genuine, legitimate area of public policy interest for this scandal to be exposed and for everybody to see that this is how the swamp operates. Joining us now for California Corner is our friend, the brilliant Susan Shelley. And you've got another brilliant column, Susan, which I'm really interested in because it's such a, as always, you go into the details. And the details are what really reveal what's going on in so many of the political stories we follow, especially here in California, where the rest of the media just doesn't cover any of this stuff. Tell us what you have been uncovering.
Well, I was notified that there were emergency regulations issued by the California Department of Justice regarding firearm safety instruction. And I thought, that's odd. What emergency are we in that they're issuing emergency regulations in December when no one's paying attention, everyone's out doing holiday things, and now there's an emergency regulation, and with emergency regulations, instead of the regular public comment process, everything's compressed 5 days, boom. And today, which
5 days.
5 days, and we were, it was announced on the 8th, and the last day was the 15th.
Uh-huh.
So what these are doing is changing the rules for who can be a firearms instructor in California. If you want to get a concealed carry permit, you have to have a firearm safety training course. Mm-hmm. And what they're doing is they're saying only organizations that are controlled by the state of California can give these classes. So NRA certified instructors are out. And if you've been trained as a firearms instructor by the U.S. military, that's not good enough. And if you've been trained by federal law enforcement, that's not good enough. And if you've been trained by the federal government, any agency at all, that's not good enough. What's good enough? Only agencies that are under the control of the California government, like the Department of Consumer Affairs and the Police Standards and Training Commission, and any school that's chartered and accredited by the state of California to give those classes. So why are they doing
Interesting.
This?
Yeah, why are they doing? What's going on? Does it connect to that Supreme Court case that
it
was
last?
It certainly
does. Okay. It certainly does. In 2022, the U.S. Supreme Court said that a New York law that restricted concealed carry permits too much was unconstitutional. You couldn't say essentially that no one can have a concealed carry permit unless they can show they've been threatened with death or something really severe like that. That's what they were doing. And they had this good moral character clause that was completely subjective. The Supreme Court threw it out. California had the same kind of law. So what California did is to get around this decision, rather than just accept it, that they have to respect the Second Amendment, rather than accept it, they passed Senate Bill 2, which restricts all the places where you can carry a gun, even if you have the permit. So essentially, you can't carry it anywhere. And then in addition to that, they said that the current penal code regulation that lists all the people who can be firearms instructors to give the required safety training class for the permit, they're going to ignore that. This is in the law. They're going to ignore that. And they're going to say a regulation from the Justice Department will be the rule instead. And that's what just came out, these new regulations.
That's what just came out. So you've traced it all back. It's brilliant. I mean, this is the kind of sleuthing that we need to, you know, it's so important. And people just don't follow this stuff. There's so much to this that's so interesting because it reveals how they think and how they operate. And it's not just about the actual issue of guns. And I've got something I want to say about that. But actually, before we get to that, it's so fascinating how they do, you know, these are the people, remember, who endlessly lecture us and everyone else about, you know, the rule of law and Trump undermining the rule of law and Trump's going to be a dictator and Trump's an authoritarian and all this kind of stuff. Because they, you know, the prospect, this is all the coverage you get, you know, in the sort of left-leaning media that this is what's going to happen with Trump because he's an authoritarian dictator. Meanwhile, that's what they do the whole time, is ignore the law. You know, like you see it at the federal level, where Biden just completely ignored the rule, you know, the actual law and the specific Supreme Court ruling on the student loan forgiveness. Just ignored it. You know, hundreds of billions of dollars. Just did it anyway. And this is another example of that at the state level with California, where they're just ignoring it and saying, right, how do we, you know, we don't like that ruling from the Supreme Court. So we're just going to figure out a way to get around it.
That's what they're doing. They're trying to keep the law the way it was before the federal government told them they couldn't have the law, which is interestingly, the historical precedent for this is the old Confederacy after the Civil War, because what happened after the 13th Amendment was ratified to ban slavery in the United States, the states like Mississippi in the Deep South decided they were going to pass state laws. They were called the Black Codes, and they were notorious. They tried to keep the former slaves in a condition that was as close to slavery as possible. They couldn't own property, and they had to sign long contracts to work in the growing season. They could not leave in the middle, or they would be arrested for quitting the job. Things like that. So the Congress passed a Civil Rights Act in 1866, and the 14th Amendment was parallel to that so that no future Congress could just reverse it by a majority vote. And they shut down the Black Codes. They said the states cannot violate fundamental rights. They can't do it with these laws that they're passing. And what are California and New York doing? The same thing with Second Amendment rights.
Exactly. And actually, to be honest, whatever your view on the gun issue, you know, there's a really important principle here, which they're just totally flouting because it suits them politically. So that's the first point that comes out of this, the broad point, which before we even get to the guns issue, right, there's the broad point, which is that these people, this sort of endless projection about, you know, Republicans being dictators and authoritarians, they're the ones that constantly undermine the rule of law and ignore it when it suits their political purposes. Next point, I thought it was fascinating the sort of detail you shared with us there, which was how they went about this in terms of the process, where they did this expedited rulemaking process, where they just had 5 days and slipped it out so that people wouldn't even be aware of it, basically. And that's just it's just the tricks they use to avoid scrutiny, to avoid public accountability. And this is an example to me of just this completely out of control, big government, regulatory state, whatever language you want to use, the administrative state, deep state, et cetera. We have all of that here in Sacramento, just as it exists in Washington at the federal level.
Exactly. And it's unfortunate because a lot of people are first-time gun owners with crime the way it is, and they are going to need a safety training course. And California will not certify all of these people who are certified under the current law. They will not be able to offer these safety training courses. So the wait time will be longer, the cost will be higher, and California controls all of it. So they could make all kinds of rules about what has to be taught, how expensive it is, all of this.
To put people off. Now let's speak to the gun issue specifically. First of all, the context, exactly as you said, why do more and more people want to own guns in California? Because they have no confidence anymore in law enforcement, because you've had this relentless campaign to undermine the police defund the police, demoralize the police, the police officers leaving, the number of police officers is way below what it should be in pretty much every police force, certainly those in Democrat-run cities. So you've got the police totally undermined, so there's less policing, and the policing you get is less effective. Then you have the prosecution aspect of it, the DAs with their kind of total, you know, like the worst example, Gascon, but you see it especially, well, actually, the worst example right now is in Oakland, just across the where from where I live in the Bay Area. I mean, just a total collapse of law and order because of the interplay of those issues, the undermining of policing and the far left prosecutorial agenda, which basically is, you know, legalizing crime effectively. So in the face of all that, people are rightly worried. They see the stories and they see the data and they feel unsafe. And they know that the police aren't going to be there to protect them and the system isn't there working as it should be to protect them. So they want to feel safe. They want to protect their family and their property. And by the way, this is not some kind of, you know, if people, you know, want to characterize this as kind of, you know, MAGA Republicans in rural California. No, I know personally many people who are Democrats who are so sick of the crime and who would never have thought of themselves as gun owners or put themselves in that, if you like, that cultural category of the gun owning community, have bought guns specifically for the tradition, Democrats. So that's the context. It's a response to their failure to maintain law and order. And then the second point I wanted to make on the guns issue is you the other thing you have to, just as they're restricting gun ownership, right, they're the other thing that they're doing is lessening the penalties for gun crime, for gun violence. That, again, through the prosecutorial agenda that they're implementing, where they're reducing the penalties. But also when they blocked in the legislature that bill from Bill Esaley, Republican Assembly member, which would have increased penalties for crimes committed either where a gun was used or where a gun was carried, to increase those penalties as a deterrent, the Democrats blocked it. They blocked it. So for all their kind of preaching about gun violence and the epidemic of gun violence, we must do something. No, they're actually reducing the penalties for gun violence. So what it really reveals is that the Democrats are not actually, they don't care about gun violence or gun crime. What they really care about is gun ownership. That's what they're really against.
Yes. And this is unfortunate because people need to feel safe. And by exactly what you're describing, by restricting the police, by defunding the police, and by releasing criminals who are violent back into the society, people are actively in danger. And it's, you know, everything that the Democrats say they want to do, they want walkable cities, they want mass transit. Well, that involves a certain amount of being out vulnerable to criminals if criminals are out preying on people. And particularly for women, for older people, for kids, you're very vulnerable standing out on a bus stop. So is it a surprise that mass transit is failing in the Bay Area, failing in Los Angeles? Mm-hmm. Ridership is falling. People don't feel safe. We are living in the kind of era where you want to roll up your windows, lock your doors, and be in your private car in a locked parking lot at each end. And that is not what government is supposed to enable. Government is supposed to enable freedom and liberty for everyone, which means safe streets. Mm-hmm. And people can be deprived of their rights with due process of law. So criminals can be deprived of their rights after a trial in which all of their rights are respected. The society has the power to imprison people who are preying on other people. Because if you don't do that, then what kind of society do you have?
Exactly. It's the collapse of civilized society, and that's what we're seeing. And what's their response? To make it harder for people to give themselves that sense of protection and security. It's just really staggering, but not surprising, because this is what you have on every single issue now. Again, the broader point we must always make for this group of Democrats today who are in charge, it's the hard left. It's totally about ideology. That's what matters. It's not about anything resembling, you know, practicality, what's the real world outcome, any kind of common sense thinking. No, it's about maintaining an ideological position and signaling to their activists that they're doing that. That's all they really care about.
Well, at some point, there are going to have to be some centrist Democrats who step forward and say, this doesn't speak for me.
Yeah.
And if they do that, they will win elections. So where are they?
Yeah, good point. I think actually more, you know, sooner than that, you're going to get, I think increasingly people are turning to the Republicans even here in California. And I think that's, you know, that's going to be the shock to the system, that the wake up call for the Democrats. We'll see.
You could be right.
So let's just flip to another thing that's going on in California and just close with this one. Because again, I think it's just, you know, people don't go enough behind the headlines. So the headline was the announcement from the state's finance people the other week that we're heading for this massive deficit, $68 billion deficit, which is a turnaround from the $100 billion surplus. So what's going to happen? They're going to have to address it in the budget, and they'll be cut. And there's already speculation about what's going to be cut and so on. But the real point that people need to understand about this is the one of the biggest drivers of the increasing spending in the California budget. I mean, the immediate reason for the deficit is the shortfall in revenue, because they rely so much on the higher earners, capital gains tax. When the stock market goes down, that sort of hurts revenues, the rich people leaving the state, driven out, businesses driven out. So there's a shortfall in revenue that's immediately caused it. But on the spending side, the big driver of California's budget, eclipsing many whole areas of spending now, is what they give to their donors, i.e. the government unions, in luxury pensions and healthcare. And the bill for that just keeps going up and up and up. They don't want to touch it because it's basically a bribe. The unions give them donations and political support and door knocking and all the rest of it. And in exchange, they give them luxury pensions and healthcare, way in excess of what everyone else can expect to be entitled to. And by the way, way in excess of what you see in other Democrat-run states. I mean, if you compare what California unions get in terms of their post-retirement income, whether that's pensions, healthcare, and all the other benefits, it's massively more than in places like Washington State or Oregon or wherever. You know, even on that comparison, it's way over the top. But they're not going to touch that. That just keeps going up. So what's going to end up happening is that the services that we all use and depend on, they're the things that are going to be cut, while their donors, the government unions, keep raking it in.
Exactly. I think a lot of people don't realize that the pension debt has to be paid first. That's not something you can cut or defer. That must be paid, not just by the state, but by all the cities and the counties and everyone who's giving these contracts. And then they come to you for tax increases because they don't have enough money to pay for current expenses. But what they're really doing is they're paying these, as you said, bribes to people who knock on doors for them. And if you don't pay them the bribe, they'll knock on doors for some other candidate. And that's the real threat that these incumbents face, is that they'll be primaried, essentially, within their own party. They'll be primaried, and the union will stop supporting them, and they'll lose. And all they want to do is hang on to the jobs. So they don't care about the future. They don't care about the taxpayers. Those pension debts are paid first, and so are the bond debts. A lot of times people get their ballot, and they see bonds. They think it's free money. It's not free money. It's coming out of, if it's a local bond, it's on the property tax bill. It's an extra charge below the line where you see all those voter approved debt charges. That's all the local bonds for all the wonderful things they're going to do for you, supposedly, and never actually do. And the state bonds, that's coming out of the general fund, and that has to be paid first ahead of current expenses also. So the more they commit to debt and pensions and higher salaries in these contracts that can't be changed, the deeper in the hole we get, the more they come at us for tax increases. And we're all looking around and saying, well, where are the services for these tax increases? And of course, there aren't any.
Brilliant. You laid that out so clearly. And we have to understand this. And, you know, we've ended up with, and that's why we have, one of the reasons why we have the highest taxes in the country, because of this cycle. And of course, it's a downward spiral, because the high taxes drive businesses away, as we mentioned. And therefore, the revenue goes down. So there's even more of a shortfall. And so what do? They never think to say, well, let's actually reform the drivers of this, because they can't, because they're obliged to them politically.
Exactly. And they have this ideological view that progressive tax codes are very good. So they want to hit the high earners with, right now it's a 13.3% top rate. And even at a lower, like middle class, upper middle class, it's 9.3, I think, or 9.6. And so it's going to go up because they're taking the cap off a payroll tax. So the top rate will actually be 14.4, effectively, for wealthy people. If you want to go to a state that has lower income taxes than California, you have 49 other choices.
Exactly. And this is what's so laughable. Let's just end on this. In that debate the other week, you and I don't think we've talked about it since then. I mean, just the brazenness, the shamelessness with which all these facts were just brushed aside in that debate. And Gavin used to have that point about, the point he was trying to make about Florida actually being higher taxed than working people in Florida being higher taxed, which is so totally bogus.
It's just sophistry. It's just playing with numbers to be misleading. One of the things, I saw a study last March that figured in property taxes. So what they did is they assumed that a median earner owned a median priced house, which doesn't happen. And then they figured in the property taxes. And because of Proposition 13, California's property taxes are not the highest in the country. They're not the lowest, but they're not the highest. And that brought the average down a little bit. But if you're paying the 7.25% state sales tax plus the local taxes, and you're paying the gas taxes, and you're paying all the hidden taxes that raise the cost of energy and gasoline and everything else that you buy that's moved in a truck, it is not a low tax state. And I don't care what the governor says. He can make those numbers sit up and spit peanuts. It's not true.
Exactly. Let's add into that, because it's an issue I focused on a lot. The hidden tax specifically paid by homeowners, which is the impact fees on house building, which one is even aware of. But that massively increases the price of the houses that people buy. And that's why it's so unaffordable. But if you can afford a house, the price you pay, a big chunk of that goes to the impact fees, they're called, which are the taxes levied on the person who, on the company that built the house, on the developer. So they have to pay it to the government, and then that goes into the price. That's another hidden tax. And big one for a lot of people.
The cost of living in California is so high that we have the highest poverty rate in the nation. Yeah. California has the highest poverty rate in the nation when the cost of living is calculated in. And there's no reason that that has to be the case. These are policy choices.
Exactly.
And we could do it. We could do it differently.
As we're on this issue, all the others, all heading in the wrong direction, we do need a big turnaround. We will be focused on that next year for sure. Susan, thank you so much. This is probably the last time we'll speak to each other this year. So Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. We'll see you in 2024.
Happy New Year to you and to all your viewers. Thank you, Steve.
All right. Here's something I want to get off my chest. The other big phrase of the week, I just touched on it actually in our conversation with Susan Shelley. You've really seen it take off in the last couple of weeks, actually. There's been a big piece in The Atlantic on it, and the New York Times have been going on about it. This concept, this idea that Trump's going to be a dictator. Trump is an authoritarian. If he's elected again, it's going to be the end of democracy. They literally say this, right? There's one of these video edits going around, you may have seen it, of all these people just absolutely hysterically talking about what's going to happen if Trump is reelected.
You can't imagine the things that he's going to do. Mexico, Canada. We can't go to Canada because eventually Canada will become annexed to America.
And shoot visitors to the White House.
Yeah,
that means he can shoot the First Lady.
We're going to see violence the likes of which we didn't even see on January 6th.
This is not kind of a pitch for Trump or a get pro Trump or anything. It's just saying that when you have this level of hysteria from these people, it just totally undermines their argument. I mean, if you've seen this edit, you have Liz Cheney, for example, who's basically, as we talked about on the last episode, just hawking her book. I saw her on one of these things saying, if Trump wins, it may be the last election you can vote in. I mean, she literally said that. And you've got people saying he's a dictator and he's like Mussolini. They invoke Mussolini and Hitler, authoritarian, and so on. And the reason it's so laughable, it's actually nothing to do with Trump. And the person who pointed this out most brilliantly this week was a writer in the Wall Street Journal. She's fantastic. She writes a column every week, Alyssa Finley. She's actually been a guest on this show before a while back. And she wrote an absolutely brilliant column about this, pointing out, I'll just read you there. I'm going to read big chunks of this article because it's really good. And here's the headline. Trump as dictator is a classic case of projection. Subtitle, Biden and his supporters try to excuse and deflect attention from their own authoritarian actions. And that is exactly what's going on here. It's just so laughable. They go on and on about Trump being a dictator, all the while when they're behaving in increasingly authoritarian ways, which we've seen. I mean, by the way, of course, we saw it in the pandemic. All of that, totally authoritarian. absolutely unbelievable restrictions on our liberty imposed from on high in a dictatorial manner. Ridiculous. Totally unjustified, seizing power. Of course, they want to continue it, but it's not just on that. I mean, we saw it most vividly in that. But you see, in so many policy issues, and Alyssa Finley does a brilliant job of itemizing it. I'm just going to go through it. But the sort of setup, as she explains it again, I'm just quoting from her article. The portrayal of Mr. Trump as a would-be dictator is a textbook case of psychological projection, the process by which people avoid confronting their own unwanted thoughts, feelings, or behaviors by subconsciously ascribing them to others. Psychologists refer to this as a defense mechanism. President Biden and his supporters project their own authoritarian impulses onto Mr. Trump because they don't want to come to terms with their own illiberalism. The examples in the Biden presidency are rife. And here she goes through them. I mean, you know, one of them we just touched on, which is the student debt, right? So here's, they keep going on about Trump's going to undermine the rule of law or whatever, ignore, you know, the courts and so. That's what they did with the student debt thing. They, $500 billion, an enormous amount of money, $500 billion. They were told they can't do it, that it's Congress can only Congress can authorize something like that. The Supreme Court ruled on it, right? And they just totally ignored it. They went round the back and did it a different way. They used regulations. They fiddled around with regulations to write off and $770 billion in student debt. I mean, that's just the most egregious and obvious example. But there's other things, you know, on this list, in this column, banning evictions, mandating COVID vaccines. The Supreme Court, you know, tried to block the administration from doing all of that, but it did it anyway. Here we are. Mr. Biden has abused his authority under the 1906 Antiquities Act to wall off nearly 1.5 million acres of land from fossil fuel development. Again, it's like whether you're for it or against it, it's not the point. He's just trying to evade constitutional parameters. I mean, they keep talking about the guardrails, right? All these historians, these pompous historians on TV, Michael Beschloss, who's the other one? John Meacham, endlessly sort of blathering on about the constitutional guardrails. The Trump doesn't care about the Constitution. Well, neither does their guy. I mean, and the examples just go on and on. Here's another one. Biden reconstructed the Clean Air Act to shut down coal and gas power plants and ban gasoline-powered cars, ignored Congress's command to lease federal land for oil and gas drilling, and dallied on holding auctions even after being ordered by a federal court to do so. His administration has failed to enforce the nation's immigration laws, paroling millions of migrants into the U.S. rather than detaining them at the border or holding them in Mexico while they await hearings. You know, they keep bringing up this idea of retribution, that Trump's going to use, you know, abuse his power to go after his enemies. Well, what do you think they've been doing, the Democrats and their media allies, apart from going after their enemies, as Alyssa Finley points out brilliantly? They've threatened social media companies with retribution, including antitrust lawsuits, if they don't censor speech that progressives dislike. The Fifth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in September ruled that Biden officials had violated the First Amendment by colluding with tech platforms to squelch politically disfavored speech about COVID and elections. Here's another one about retribution. And this has been documented. If you look at what they've done in relation to Elon Musk, so they can't stand Elon Musk now because he exposed what they're doing in censorship after he bought Twitter and allowed, free speech on Twitter. So what's their response? Again, quoting from this article, a phalanx of regulators, the Federal Trade Commission, Securities and Exchange Commission, National Labor Relations Board, and Justice Department has targeted Elon Musk's companies for sundry regulatory infractions after the tech entrepreneur criticized Democrats' leftward lurch and recommended Americans vote for Republicans in the 2022 midterms. I mean, they go on about, you know, targeting their political, they literally say, oh, if Trump's elect, he's going to use the Justice Department to go after his political enemies. I mean, my goodness, have they seen the lawsuits that Trump's got piled up against him? It's just a laughable example, exactly as this brilliant column says, of projection. All this talk about Trump being a dictator. I mean, here's the summary. And again, I want to read it to you because it's so great. Abuse executive power, ignore the law, run roughshod over individual liberties, retaliate against political opponents. Mr. Biden and his allies have done exactly what they warn Mr. Trump will do if he returns to the White House. Unlike Mr. Biden, however, Mr. Trump would have to contend with a hostile media and federal bureaucracy that would be trying to thwart him at every step. So this is just a joke, all this talk they are doing the exact thing that they accused Trump of planning to do. It is just ludicrous, and yet another example of the utter derangement that has taken hold of the anti-Trump people, whether it's people like Liz Cheney in the Republican Party, or the media, or the Democrats, all of them. It is just an absolute joke. All right, everybody, that is our show for today. That's our show for this week, and that's our show for this year. I'm going to be heading over to England. We always go back at Christmas time to see family and friends in England, and then heading over for a quick trip to Madrid, Spain, actually, with some friends over New Year. So that's going to be fun. We will be back here raring to go in the new year. There's going to be so much going on. It's going to be a massive year, obviously, with politics and policy. You've got the presidential election, but also lots going on. We've got very important elections in California for those of us focused on the fight here to bring common sense back to our state. It's a big year here as well. So going to be lots to cover, lots of great conversation. Thank you so much for being with us this year. We really, really appreciate it. Make sure you tell everyone about the show. Make sure you follow us, of course, on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. And we will see you in 2024. Merry Christmas and Happy New Year, everybody.